Welcome to Worlds Apart. In all Abrahamic religions, the proportionality of violence is a major tenet, and Judaism is no exception. In fact, according to the Talmudic interpretation, the Second Temple was destroyed exactly as a punishment for gratuitous hatred, which once again seems to be driving events in the Middle East. Can religious or perhaps political ideas offer any respite from the bloodshed and retaliation engulfing the Holy Land? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ramzi Barood, a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. Dr. Barood, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
And thank you for having me.
Now, Dr. Barood, I just used this term, the Holy Land, which many people today associate with the state of Israel. But historically, as I'm sure you know, it refers to the entire area between the Mediterranean Sea and the eastern bank of the Jordan River, which includes the Palestine. And this is where I want to start. What is Palestine to you at this point? Because it's not a state, and yet it's not fully devoid of state structures or a phantom of a state. So what is it?
For Palestinians, Palestine was on its way to becoming a nation state in the modern sense. But there was a disruption that has happened, particularly when Britain in 1917, through the so-called Balfour Declaration or the Balfour Promise, has granted Israel to the Zionist movement, and in doing so, creating this disruption in the historical cycle. Palestine was becoming a state like all other states in the region, but that date and the events that led to the creation of Israel between 1917 and 1948 changed these dynamics entirely. So the modern Palestinian state and the modern Palestinian struggle is really essentially a political struggle, not a religious struggle, that aims at correcting that course of history that deviated because of British colonialism in Palestine and its inception and the granting of Palestine to the Zionist movement in latter years.
In English, there is this expression, hope dies last, and it's usually interpreted as something very aspirational. And yet, I think it also reflects the very dark connection between hope and death, because a promise whose realization is denied continuously is bound to lead to the very opposite of hope, which is rage, malice, despair, revenge. How much do you think this suspended hope have to do with what's happening in Gaza today?
Right. So there has really been periods in our history in which I can't deny that indeed there was this kind of collective sense of despair. And this collective sense of despair followed political promises that were not fulfilled. For example, after the Madrid negotiations in 1991, after the Oslo Accords in 1993, this promise that everything is going to be okay, our people are going to be okay, Israel will stop building settlements and there will be a Palestinian state. And to even make it more difficult for that collective Palestinian hope is that they gave us enough symbols, flag, a national anthem, membership at various international institutions. Our national team became an actual football team that is competing in Olympics and so forth and so on. And that kind of buoyed that sense of hope that indeed something real, tangible is happening. But from a political point of view, the exact opposite has happened. The number of Jewish settlements tripled. The number of Palestinians killed tripled. The number of Jewish settlers moved to the West Bank, contrary to international law, has increased exponentially. So that you have this kind of parallel realities where we are feeding on hope. Nothing is really happening on the ground. And that led to the sense of despair that we have seen during the Second Intifada and the suicide bombing phenomenon and all of that.
Now, Dr. Baruch, do you think that was a conscious strategy, or do you think that was, you know, something, you know, the hard reality that did not facilitate the finding of a compromise? Because the Americans like to say that, you know, perception is reality. Do you think there was a conscious attempt to create that perception while denying reality, or do you think that just the way history developed?
It is certainly the former, not the latter, and we know that. Because for rational reasons, I mean, you can't fund settlements, illegal settlements. You can't fund the Israeli military with $3.8 billion a year. And at the same time, still recognize Palestinian rights in the areas that are being appropriated by the settlements. Or the Palestinian people's right to exist while you are funding the very military that is denying them that right to exist. So there was obviously something political, and it was a perception that the Americans were trying to market. Americans are very good with branding. So they really created this brand, and they sold that brand, and they decided that if you do not agree with this brand, you are a radical, you are a terrorist sympathizer, you are anti-American, and you don't want peace. But also there are actual statements made by the likes of Weissglass, for example, who was a top advisor to former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who made it very clear in 2005 that we are selling Palestinians the idea that there will be a state and there will be no state. There will be a peace process, but to the contrary, what we are trying to say, and that's Israeli media published this is not our own interpretation, we want to put Palestinians on a diet, he said, but we don't want to kill them.
I think for anyone who has even the most basic understanding of collective psychology, it's pretty obvious that Gaza has become a very dangerous human experiment because it is bound to produce radicalism and resistance and I think even terrorism as a natural way of opposing oppression. You cannot deny dignity to, you know, successive generations of people for way too long. I mean, I wonder, what do you think the Israeli and perhaps the Western leadership counted on? Did they truly believe, in your view, that they can sort of seal this problem off in a hermetic fashion?
Two things. Number one, the Israelis are living in total isolation. The media there, if you read Hebrew media, Israeli media, it's like they are in a different world. They are unaware. Like, for example, the whole term that what happened on October 7 was unprovoked. They actually have internalized this. They believed it. They don't think that occupation, apartheid, sieges, massacres, killings, violence. The United Nations said that 2022 was the most violent year in the West Bank since 2005. Then they came back again and they said in 2023, by June, it was the most violent year in the West Bank since 2005. Gaza is a completely different story. Gaza has already been declared uninhabitable by the United Nations years and years ago. But in the minds of the Israelis, because of the propaganda that has been in Israeli media, it is completely unprovoked. We have no idea why these people hate us so much. That's the problem. In the American media, it's a different story. In the American media, they have established this connection that what Israel is doing, Israel is a great democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East, and that Israel represents the hopes and dreams of the great Western civilizations. And they are fighting a war against Islamic terrorism. And there is no difference between ISIS and Hamas and so forth and so on. So the Americans have a different layer of indoctrination that makes them completely blind, at least mainstream media and government, completely blind to the plight of the Palestinians over the course of 75 years.
Now, the 75 years living under conditions most of us would recognize as highly traumatic. I think there is no dispute about it. It's bound to produce collective trauma. Let me ask you a hypothetical question here, because it's easy to blame Israel and the Americans and the West, but do you think the so-called allies or supporters of the Palestinian people would actually, in practicality, welcome a workable solution? Because when you deal with so many people who have been troubled psychologically, economically, logistically, in all the possible ways, do you think the neighbors of Palestine would actually want to see it free and existing as a state?
Right, so there are two different types of neighbors of Palestinians. Not very good neighbors, and I don't want to go into specifics to distract from the conversation, but these are the American allies. And they work their political agenda to accommodate two elements. Number one, they don't want too much trouble amongst their own people. Revolts, maybe even military coups. And there's some serious fears that in a couple of these Arab countries, there is some worry that there could be a military coup if Palestinians are continuing to be slaughtered at this rate. But they are also wanting to accommodate the American diktats, and they want to stay on the good side of Washington.
They want allies to minimize their own risks. I mean, like in practical terms, that are also understandable. This is a valid political motivation. That's why I'm asking the same question. Do you think they actually want the resolution of the Palestinian issue? Because as inhumane as it seems right now, it seems to be keeping the lead in place and making sure that the region is not troubled anymore.
I think it kind of depends, Oskana, on the kind of solution we are talking about. If Palestinians are indeed granted a minimal definition of justice, as in a Palestinian state, that may be a step towards a future of a federation or one state where people can travel, come and go, have freedom, have political rights, can vote, I don't see why this would be a problem for Jordan or Egypt or anyone. To the contrary, it's going to open up the space for not just for socioeconomic equality in the region, but for economic prosperity as well. The Americans have the keys to all of this. The Americans don't want to do it, even though it actually, by not doing it, it destabilized the regions that the Americans want stable. But they are not doing it because there is a far-right government in Israel. And the Israelis don't want any kind of resolution that seems contrary to whatever ultimate goal they have in Palestine.
Now, you have written recently that one takeaway from this crisis is that Gaza has ended the sectarian war in the Middle East, that, you know, regardless of whether people are Sunni, identify themselves as Sunni or Shia, they tend to support the... not even the Palestinian cause, they tend to resent what is what the Gaza people are being subjected to. Do you think that kind of effect could be lasting and perhaps even game-changing? Because, I mean, empathy is very natural at this point of time, but is it enough to move the situation from where it has been for many, many decades?
Absolutely. The American program in the Middle East is situated within division, divide and conquer. It's as simple as that. I remember when the Americans invaded Iraq in 2003, they intentionally divided Iraq into Shia zones, Sunni zones. Everybody knows that. Even though I visited Iraq prior to that, and I didn't really see this kind of sectarian conflict so ugly and happening on a daily basis. For the first time since the American invasion of Iraq back then until today, I have not seen, for example, in Egypt, Sunni protesters chanting the names of Hassan Nasrallah, a Shia leader. Lebanese protesters, Shia protesters, chanting the names of Sunni Arab leaders. This is completely new.
But Dr. Baroud, is it enough to consolidate that into something tangible, into tangible political solutions that will change the destiny of the Palestinian people, rather than simply being used for political purposes in those countries?
And that's the struggle. And that's the struggle. And that's what we are going to start seeing manifest in the coming era. The Americans and the Israelis and their allies want the region to be frozen exactly where it is because it serves their interests. There is another camp, Iran, Hezbollah, Yemen, Palestine, specific sections of Palestinian society and elsewhere, that is trying to create a new political paradigm. And I think the outcome of this paradigm is going to change the geopolitics of the Middle East itself, but also the Middle East vis-a-vis new political actors, whether being Russia, China, Turkey and others.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Baroud, let me stop you right here. We will talk about how exactly that could manifest in a couple of minutes. But for now, stay tuned.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact. Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ramzi Barut, a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. Dr. Barut, before the break, we started talking about the American role in this whole conflict. And you wrote recently that the Gaza issue has become quite a liability for the Biden administration and the Democratic Party more broadly, that this rhetorically sacred bond between Israel and the United States is becoming more of a geopolitical bondage for the Americans. Do you think that this inner pressure or the discomfort that the Biden administration may feel on the issue may lead to some covert pressure on the Netanyahu government? Because let's face it, the Americans can be pretty ruthless even with their own allies when their own American interests are affected.
There are so many moving pieces here. Israel is now going back to the status of the client regime, which is really interesting. This is a conversation we've had regarding the Middle East for many years. Is Israel a client regime, or is, as they say, the tail is wagging the dog? And I think there is a struggle now where some in Israel itself are afraid, and they have been saying this out loud, including Tamar Ben-Gvir and others within the right wing or far right government, that we are going back to that kind of status where the Americans telling us what to do. And there are those who are still insisting that Israel has not lost its political power, influence, and credibility, and we make our own decisions. So I think one of the moving pieces is that will the Israelis find themselves going back to the 1980s and even earlier, where the Americans dictate Israeli policies in the Middle East, or will they continue this new empowered approach where they are the deciders, per the words of George W. Bush back in the day? So that's one of the moving pieces. The other one is, how will this war affect the relationships between the Democratic Party, especially the rank and file, with the elites who are still very kind of diehard supporters of Tel Aviv? We are going to see this in coming elections. And we are beginning to see changes happening in terms of numbers, especially with younger Democratic voters who are making Gaza and Palestine an issue in their perception of Biden.
Now, I'm joining you from Moscow, and here in Russia, we have this cliche that the Americans are always trying to impose their solutions onto everybody else. But in order to impose solutions, you have to have them, full stop. Do you think the current American administration even has an idea of how they can try to approach this very combustible issue? Because even if they only want to use it for political purposes, for appearances, you still need to offer something. And the situation seems to be so dire that it's very hard to understand where even to start or what to exploit.
And this is one of the unprecedented outcomes of what's happening right now, regardless of how we feel about what took place on October 7th and the legitimacy or lack thereof. This is the first time in many years in which the Americans are not the ones who have taken the initiative. We all know Naomi Klein's famous book, The Shock Doctrine, and the idea that you just go and you just take advantage of an existing disaster, or you impose one and you try to reorganize the pieces to fit your foreign policy agenda. This time, the Americans were taken by surprise as much as the Israelis were taken by surprise. But what Antony Blinken and other American officials, Jake Sullivan and all the rest, are trying to do here, they are pretending that nothing has changed, that they are, in fact, the ones in charge. The G7 is holding meetings to talk about the future of Gaza without Hamas, as if they have been the ones who created this whole scenario, and they are the only ones who are capable of influencing the outcome of this scenario. And this is the biggest political crisis, I think, for the Americans in a long, long time in the Middle East, is that there is a new reality that's imposed on the Americans. They are still trying to kind of show resolve, and they are in charge, but in actuality, they are no longer the ones in the leadership position, and they don't know what the outcome is going to be.
I want to ask you one religious or political question here, because there have been some recent studies that I read recently that Israel and prominent Jewish businessmen throughout the 20th century have sought to essentially intertwine religious and political discourse, particularly so in the United States and particularly among the so-called Zionist Christians, making them believe that the second coming of Christ is intrinsically linked to the political state of Israel. And this is a very, tenuous connection, because if people vote in favor of, supporting military government in a different land because of their worldview, that could create a lot of problems. And Americans are, as we know, still very powerful player. What do you think about it? Do you think that problem has been given enough attention? And the political implications of using the religious discourse for creating support for Israel.
When you have top U.S. senators calling for religious war or saying this is a religious war, it's terrifying, because you are no longer talking about people within the establishments who have kind of sinister ideas. No, you're talking about people within government, and we know that the Israelis have already reached the conclusion that it is a religious war, and they made that very clear. Even those who are being sold to the rest of us as moderates or centrists in Israeli politics, they are using very biblical language, as in turning Gaza into ashes, eradicating the Palestinians. I mean, terrifying, terrifying language. Now, this must be differentiated from the language that is used by Islamic political forces in Palestine. And this is quite a complicated issue. I just want to kind of highlight two things. Faith sometimes can be used as a sword, where you go and destroy and kill in the name of God. And sometimes faith can be used as a shield. And we see this with Palestinian Muslims, but Christians. I mean, we have seen a Christian mosque, a Christian church and a Christian hospital being destroyed. And we have seen the language emanating from the Christian community in Gaza is very faith-oriented. They see themselves as Palestinians first, but Christians second. So this is different. And this whole idea that they are actually fighting religious fundamentalism, the sad reality is that the exact opposite. It is us who are fighting, or Palestinians who are fighting this religious fundamentalism, and we are using faith as a way to stay strong under the harshest of circumstances.
Now, you work for the Center for Islam and Global Affairs, and I'm sure you're quite familiar with this discourse of how potentially dangerous political Islam could be. I mean, a couple of years ago, it was a very popular topic. Do you see any difference between political Islam and, let's say, political Zionism in this particular case?
Yes, of course. And I am excluding groups that could be directly or potentially manipulated and used by Western governments to achieve political agendas in Syria or elsewhere. I'm not going to talk about these guys. And I'm also excluding groups that
have. And by the way, those guys are usually termed as terrorists, by the way. I mean, like, there is no argument that ISIS, for example, was a brand of terrorism, even though they were political Islamists in some sense.
Exactly. I mean, that's the name of the game. You know, you kind of create or manipulate or give the space to certain groups to operate and serve your interests. And at the same time, you dub them with all sorts of things. So in order for you to create this or to present yourself as the savior of humanity. But groups like Hezbollah, like Hamas in Palestine and few others in the region, they are non-state actors, but they operate within national boundaries. They don't operate beyond national boundaries. So they don't have a jihadist mission to liberate Spain, and bring Spain back to the rule of the Islamic kingdoms of Al-Andalus or restore the caliphate. They are not in any way interested or involved in that kind of political discourse. And unless you understand that, you could easily fall into the trap of the American propaganda, that Taliban is Hamas, Hamas is ISIS, ISIS is Al-Qaeda, and so forth. And sadly, a lot of people in the U.S., because they don't allow a serious and honest conversation about these issues in mainstream media, a lot of people are buying into this, and they are behaving as if indeed Hamas and ISIS are the same political movements.
You mentioned Hezbollah and Hamas, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Hezbollah was pretty much empowered by the Israeli campaign against the PLO, whereas Hamas is a direct creation of Israel, because from what I understand, initially it was created as a civil service group, and it only through the decades of denying dignity to the Palestinian people that it turned into what it turned to. Do you think there will be any, perhaps not public, but at least internal analysis on the part of the Israeli special services or American special services about, you know, the kind of groups that they breed and what is actually supporting this resistance among the Palestinians, that it's not about the concrete group, but rather about the conditions on the ground?
Absolutely. I wrote extensively. In fact, I wrote a book about this issue, about the rise of Hamas. And I wouldn't say it was created as much as the Israelis kind of try to do these kind of social experiments, as they continue to do in Gaza and the West Bank, again, by giving a little bit of space for certain political rival to grow with the hope that they create friction and they create civil wars and that sort of thing. But indeed, this is what happened. Al-Jamal Islamiyah, the Islamic group, was the kind of the forerunner of Hamas in Gaza, and they were involved in cultural programs, universities, hospitals, charities. But when you are dealing with a grassroots organization of any kind, Islamic or any or otherwise, and that grassroots society is part of the struggle against occupation, against apartheid, naturally they are going to themselves merge to be part of that movement. So whether the Israelis intended or didn't, and I really don't think they did, Hamas has with time become the main resistance platform for Palestine in Gaza, and in fact, at this point in the West Bank as well.
Now, speaking about resistance, and my question may come across as very arrogant, but I do ask it out of deep empathy and sympathy with the Palestinian people, because when you live under the spirit of resistance and in the conditions of occupation for so long, I think the task of governing becomes very challenging. I mean, it's very challenging right now, even for the most, developed nations. But I assume it would be a very hard challenge for the people of Palestine. Do you think they're still capable of cooperating and running themselves, not just resisting?
I mean, imagine if under all of these circumstances, a Gaza government living under total siege and total political isolations managed to actually govern Gaza under these circumstances. And I know you're not going to talk about a perfect scenario here, but they actually did manage to govern Gaza to some extent under all of this. I think they are more than capable of doing so. But it's the external pressures that makes it so impossible. Like right now, 60% of Gaza has been either fully or partially destroyed. It's going to take, the last number I've heard a few days ago, that it's going to take about $3 billion, but now we might be looking at $4 or $5 billion to govern Gaza. They are not even allowed to bring water into Gaza, to bring food into Gaza, because of the pressure by Israel and the United States. How are they, you know, are going to be responsible for rebuilding Gaza and bringing all of this money? And so, yes, they are capable of doing so if the external pressures allow them or ease up enough for the rebuilding of Gaza to take place.
Well, Dr. Baroud, on this very dark note, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.